Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Nearly one in five adolescents in the U.S. has a diagnosable mental health disorder, and nearly one-third of them show signs of depression. That's according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, using data compiled before the pandemic. COVID-19 since March has upended important routines, increased isolation, and magnified the gaps in the U.S. mental health care system for children and adolescents. Fewer than 300 psychiatrists are available to serve Ohio's 2.6 million kids. Child psychiatrists aren't available in more than half of Ohio's 88 counties, where behavioral health services, if available, struggle to manage the load. For those in rural areas, the need is especially acute. Dr. Patricia Gentile is a board-certified child and adolescent psychiatrist and the primary psychiatrist at the Buckeye Ranch, one of the area's oldest and largest mental health and behavioral health treatment agencies for children and families. Welcome, Dr. Gentile.
Thank you, Ann.
What are you learning at this point about how the pandemic is affecting children that you've come in contact with?
Well, the kids in our care are really struggling in terms of day-to-day structure and activities. They don't have available resources in the community that they had had. All of the camps, day camps, rec centers aren't available that had been available. So we have a lot of bored kids that are at home playing video games all day and night, not sleeping, going to bed very late, getting up very late. So their world's kind of topsy-turvy with that disrupted sleep cycle. The uncertainty around what's going on and not having control over any of it has taken a toll on everyone in the household, and this cascades down to the kids.
You know, I'm wondering if there's a sense that this is triggering mental health issues for kids who otherwise probably would have been able to kind of, you know, surf through. Otherwise?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, stress is one of the main triggers for turning on that mental illness issue. There's people that wouldn't have mental illness had they not had stress. And this has clearly been one of those stressors. There's a lot of evidence already that there's increased anxiety and depression symptoms across United States general population. So that's trickling down into the kid population.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm talking with Dr. Patricia Gentile. She's a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Buckeye Ranch. She's primary psychiatrist at the Buckeye Ranch, one of the area's oldest and largest mental and behavioral health treatment agencies for children and families. And we're talking about child mental health today. It's always a huge problem, and the coronavirus, the pandemic, and the regulations surrounding it, the stay-home orders, that thing, the school closings, all have had an exacerbating effect. If you have a question or comment, want to share your own story today about how you're coping with the kids, maybe you are an adolescent, a teenager listening to the show right now. I know people do. I know it's it happens. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I've had entire programs, Dr. Gentile, on the lack of the shortage of child psychiatrists, not just in Ohio, but across the country. What do we know about why there is such a shortage in a field that that there's a lot of need, so a lot of demand, there's jobs out there. What do we know about that?
Well, I think it's a combination of money and stigma. We, as child and adolescent psychiatrists, are not paid as well as our peers from med school that went into other specialty areas. There's not any extra reimbursement for being a child adolescent psychiatrist as opposed to a general psychiatrist. That said, I think people that go into it have a lot of passion for this area. So it's, you get good people that go into it mm-hmm. because they're driven. But the other, you know, the stigma piece is a large one. Even in medical school, stigma starts. If you start talking about being interested in mental health or going into psychiatry, you start being kind of set aside by other professors and specialty doctor instructors. So it starts early in med school. It's not just on the ground level with patients. So I think those things feed into the lack of people going into the field. Mm-hmm. It is an exciting field. There's a lot of great research coming out on the brain and the effects of stress on the brain, how to treat it. But we have a lot of gaps getting that information out and activated.
The social piece is important to all of us, but there's critical neurodevelopment taking place in young people's brains. What's happening now that is affecting them that could have long-term effects?
Well, teen development, that brain is laying down really important pathways for decision-making and goal-setting and identity and those social interactions that you have are crucial in the development of those pathways. And not having social interaction during that time can have effect into adulthood mm-hmm. with areas of decision making and goal setting.
And by the way, let's define what we mean by, you know, adulthood and that kind of a thing. My understanding is it's still commonly, you know, considered the brain isn't fully developed, whatever that means, till someone's around 25 or older.
Right. Even up to 30 mm-hmm. For some people. So what we call adults is not, the brain's still working, still growing.
Mm-hmm.
So the young adults right now in the community have similar issues going on.
When we talk about structure, you talked about how they're playing games, you know, video games, playing all day and night and that kind of a thing. The sleep is disturbed, but they're also not getting that summer job. They didn't get to have a high school graduation. There's not a family picnic at the 4th of July. There's just it's a lot of things that they're missing.
Yes. I've heard it referred to as a regressogenic environment, where the family is, you know, quarantined at home, a kind of a forced situation, parents not working, kids not in school. There's not the time limitations that prevent you from binging on things. So there's just more binging of TV shows, movies, social media, alcohol, mm-hmm. food, drugs. And that's happening. We joke about, you know, the binge watching and so forth, but it does happen on all those levels and really sets up an environment where you're doing things that are really bad for your body and not physically active, and it increases the incidence of domestic violence in the home, child abuse. There's already been an increase in number of calls to hotlines for abuse. So it's like you're setting up a situation where the kids are kind of loosey-goosey and the family's loosey-goosey, but they're doing things that aren't healthy and not helping them to be resilient to manage the stress they're going through.
What kind of services does Buckeye Ranch provide at this point in time, given the pandemic? What are you able to do?
Well, we very rapidly went through a shift in how we provided services back in March. It was a pretty very rapid transition to telehealth for our community-based programs. Our staff really worked hard and came up with creative ideas to make the engagement with our families happen. There were definite cases where families kind of got lost to follow-up in that, and we're still working to get some of them re-engaged, with some of the challenges being we might have good Wi-Fi where we're working, but they might not. Or we have the equipment needed to do a good telehealth session, but they don't. So we've tried to get tablets that have Wi-Fi as part of it into the hands of some of our families. It's been a growing, ongoing process.
What has surprised you about the process? Anything?
Well, I'd say that there's some really positive parts of doing the telehealth. I'm getting to see kids in their own environment sometimes, and they're showing me things in their room, and they're introducing me to their dogs, and it really has added some depth, and I think it's also more convenient for families sometimes to do this. It's not as anxiety provoking as going into an office. I've had some opposite, and where kids don't want to get on the camera and they're shy about the camera, and all I see is their forehead. but it's, and I had one kiddo who was hiding behind the staircase the whole time. So it's been a broad spread. But I think that people are grateful that we're still engaging in the treatment and involved with them.
Let's take a call. Chris in Columbus, you're on the air and with Dr. Patricia Gentile of Buckeye Ranch. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. I think that part of the issue with people not realizing that children need this care is this lie that we tell ourselves that children are resilient. And I think that we just use that as an excuse to justify neglecting children. And I'm wondering how we can change our view of this, like how we can educate parents and teachers and children themselves that they do suffer from these things and that they could suffer for the rest of their life because of it.
Dr. Right. Gentile?
That's a really good question. It's a really good question. Being resilient, what does that mean? You know, are kids really resilient? The fact is that they are still developing those tools that they need in order to be resilient. You know, the things that can help you be resilient during something like this is to not personalize what's happening. When you think about your average teenager, it's kind of everything's about me. Everything's my fault. You know, I mean, they have a really hard time not personalizing things that are going on. Another thing that helps with resilience is not the understanding that this is temporary. And understanding that this isn't going to be forever. I think we're all having a struggle with that right now because it keeps going on and on. So we're all kind of wondering, well, is this forever? But it's not. And we know that at some point in time, there's going to become some new normal that we're coming to. Kids don't have the ability to have that time frame. They're in the here and now, in the all or none. Their world is now. So for them to understand that this is not permanent, they might get it at times because the remarkable thing about an adolescent brain is they have these glimmers of genius. I mean, they're it's like, oh my gosh, they're like 35 years old suddenly, but then they drop back to being 2 years old. So they kind of flip flop back and forth in their skill set. And they're not stable in who they are and the solidity that you need for sense of self to realize that this is not about me. This is not a pervasive, permanent thing. So it's a really good point that kids are not as resilient as we think they are. But they always look so resilient. It's like, we're freaking out and they seem to be playing, right? They're taking it all in. It is definitely something. It is a really good point that we overestimate just how resilient they are.
You know, I'm trying to put this in a context that makes sense. You know, you have two or three kids in a family, maybe let's say the parents get divorced or something like that, or some kind of trauma occurs. And then one of the kids is acting out a lot and they're worried about them. They don't worry about the other one. Well, he's just fine. He's just doing just fine. And then long term, wasn't fine. Looking for signs of distress in children, it's tricky, isn't it?
Oh, yes. They're protective of their parents.
So I'm just kind of using a divorce as a common experience,
right.
a common thing, but I guess the pandemic is probably bringing this out too, the differences.
So, yeah, I think you always are wanting to pay attention to the under-communication, the sub-communication, the things that kids are saying without saying things, you know, like when they're fighting with their sister or they're yelling at you and telling you you're awful, they're really probably anxious or feeling really crummy or having a bad day or, you know, so there's other things going on that's causing them to be exploding in those ways. The quiet ones, you know, I watch for anxiety in the quiet ones, you know, and you could, you know, tell stories about, you know, that, you know, make believe someone anxious, you know, there's lots of great storytelling you can do to try and pull those kids out,
mm-hmm.
have them tell their own story.
We are talking about adolescent mental health and how to manage when there's mental illness in children and adolescents. My guest right now, Dr. Patricia Gentile, she's with the Buckeye Ranch, where she is board-certified child and adolescent psychiatrist and the primary psychiatrist there, one of the area's oldest and largest mental health and behavioral health treatment agencies for children and families. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Nearly one in five adolescents in the U.S. has a diagnosable mental health disorder, and nearly one-third of them show signs of depression. Fewer than 300 psychiatrists are available to serve Ohio's 2.6 million kids. Child psychiatrists aren't available in more than half of Ohio's 88 counties, where behavioral health services, if available, struggle to manage the load. And for those in rural areas, the need is especially acute. Still with us is Dr. Patricia Gentile. She's primary psychiatrist at the Buckeye Ranch. Joining us by Zoom is Jody Demo-Hodgins. She's director for the Children's Division at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Ohio. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
And pediatric psychologist Parker Houston is the clinical director of the Nationwide Children's Hospital On Our Sleeves program, which works to break the silence surrounding child mental health. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Parker, in March, Nationwide Children's Hospital opened the Big Lots Behavioral Health Pavilion. The Dispatch reported in March that the lack of psychiatrists caused some delays with the project. We were talking about that earlier with Dr. Gentile. Tell us about the shortage issue and you know, what can be worked on to change that?
Yeah, it's a big question for us in behavioral health in general, as Dr. Gentile was saying. You know, the lack of psychiatrists in general and even more lack of child psychiatrists leads to, you know, a lot of them are coalescing in larger cities. And so, you know, we have more access here in Columbus, let's say, than someone in a rural community, let's say in Southeast Ohio. But, you know, that also centralizes care. It has people traveling farther. And, you know, there's an issue of training a relatively decent number of psychiatrists, but also hiring them and getting them into positions where they might be able to serve the greatest number of people. And so, you know, for the Behavioral Health Pavilion, I think we've prioritized trying to centralize a location where we can provide services to the largest number of kids possible. But that sort of necessarily removes some access to care from remote locations. And so we have to figure out how to best serve patients who, you know, might have to drive a few hours to get to the nearest child psychiatrist.
Is there a parallel?
So Parker,
go ahead.
Parker, this is Dr. Gentile. And I know that Children's has some programs that they've tried to put in place to address that in terms of using telehealth kind of meetings for child psychiatrists to get involved with groups of clinicians in the more rural areas, kind of a trickle down.
Yep.
From the central location to those areas. I don't know if it's through PFK, but I know that that Nationwide Children's has been doing some of that research and that it looks really good. And it might be a good model for all of us to use.
Right. You know, with a lack of providers, you know, there's two different strategies. It's either make do with what you have and try and maximize what you have, or try and influence the training and development of more people to fill those roles. And so, you know, we've used some online programming to host different types of providers, whether it's nurse practitioners or whether it's adult psychiatrists who need more experience or information on managing child psychiatry issues in rural areas, and trying to provide free training and guidance and consultation for those folks to, you know, meet the need with the current structure in place. But, you know, we also have some pretty robust training programs in the hospital as well. And, you know, trying as much as we can to attract great prospects and get people interested in these areas where more help is needed.
You know, we're pretty early on in all of this when it comes to the pandemic, all things being equal. I mean, we know logically we'll come to some kind of sense of closure about it, but it could be a long time. And as Dr. Gentile made the point earlier, with kids, it's all about what's now. You know, teenagers, you're only a teenager once, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you know, long term, do you see the pandemic changing any of paradigm of this process, Parker Houston?
Yeah, as far as providing care, I think we've already seen huge changes, and it's forced us to, in a good way, to develop novel treatment strategies, novel ways of connecting with our patients and of providing care. And, you know, what would have taken years and years of, you know, government advocacy and research and technology development has been greatly accelerated. And just to use behavioral health at the hospital as a general model for what can happen, in the first week of March this year, I think there were a total of 7 telemedicine visits through behavioral health. Mm-hmm. And about 6 weeks later, there were an average of about 5,000 per week.
Wow.
And so just the drastic uptick in that. And now we're doing research on that. We're collecting feedback and surveys from patients and families. And, you know, that's going on nationwide. Mm-hmm. About the impact of this. And so, you know, I think when it comes to serving the rural communities, the feedback that I've personally gotten has been overwhelmingly positive, because many of them were driving 2+ hours to see me.
Yeah.
Whereas now, you know, they roll out of bed and they get their kids' teeth brushed and they, you know, sit them in front of the computer and we have our session. And so it's been, our show rate has been improved because of that in some cases. And also just the access for people where transportation and, you know, the time and distance was an impediment. And so I think for psychiatry, that might be even more of a drastic change for them because they can see a larger number of patients in a larger catchment area without as much burden on the family.
You know, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about adolescent and childhood mental health issues right now, especially for people in rural areas. There's an acute demand. The need is great, and it's all been exacerbated by the pandemic. However, as Parker Houston, clinical director of the On Our Sleeves program at Nationwide Children's, there are some silver linings. The way the field is responding is creating other different kinds of opportunities. Also with us, Dr. Patricia Gentile. She's a child and adolescent psychiatrist, the lead at Buckeye Ranch, and Jody Demo Hodgins is director for the Children's Division at the National Alliance on Mental Illness Ohio. And Jody Demo Hodgins, you agree there are some reasons to be optimistic about how the field is responding at this point?
I do think there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic. One of the things that we've seen with families that participate in our Parent Advocacy Connection program is that as the representative from Children's just noted, it's easier to log into a computer program and to be able to participate in telehealth, especially those families that are receiving any kinds of trauma informed services for their kids. Those seem to be delivered in such a way that kids are engaging in them more. We do hear from parents that had not received services before for kids, especially adolescents, that sometimes it's been a challenge to get them to sit down and do that initial participation. But in general, I think clinicians' skills are being improved in terms of how to deliver and engage with people doing telehealth. So I think those are all positive things.
You know, I heard something interesting when we were talking about special needs students and the impact of the pandemic and the closure of schools and stuff on them. And a clinician who deals primarily with children, young adults who are autistic said that it was an interesting dynamic seeing them respond to the Zoom experience and actually being able to see themselves. You know, it was unexpected and it has had a really positive impact on the process. Dr. Gentile, I guess there's things that we'll learn through all of this.
Absolutely. I'm really impressed with how some of the kids have taken to it. And it's a process. The first time was iffy, but then they've kind of grown to it. It's like if you can see them blossoming. And as was pointed out, for the trauma kids, the idea of coming into an office and reliving trauma in a different space, it's so much safer when you have a little distance.
And there's
been some research on, you know, when you're doing exposure work with PTSD, you know, being on a treadmill makes it easier and more effective. People don't tend to run from the therapy so quickly. But I think it empowers them. That's probably activating part of the brain that is really important. So when kids are at home, they can be moving about in their environment while they're on their phone doing telehealth with us.
Parker Houston, were you going to say something? Or
Jeff? Yeah, I just think that's a really fascinating observation. And, you know, part of my clinical work or my primary area, in addition to what I do with On Our Sleeves, is in the pediatric feeding clinic here at the hospital. And so it's been really fascinating to me, you know, usually when I'm working with kids who are, you know, have feeding disorders of some sort, I'm watching them in my office, and it's in a different environment. And I've been invited to dinner at a lot of people's houses lately, you know, via video, where, you know, let's watch it, how it happens, and kids feel a little bit more relaxed and it's in their natural environment. And so, you know, that's some of the benefit I've seen as a clinician too, as Dr. Gentile was saying, that, you know, I can sort of see them in their typical environment, and parents seem a little bit more relaxed as well when I'm giving them some guidance or some suggestions. And so, you know, it's certainly not a perfect thing. I wouldn't advocate for using telehealth as our primary delivery model for forevermore, but I certainly think that there are, you know, some reasons and some strategies that are beneficial to using it.
And given the shortage in the rural areas, Jody Demohagens, to be able to get better at it and understand the better strategies for delivering telehealth is a good thing?
I think it's an absolutely wonderful thing. I want to also point back to one of the things that Dr. Gentile was talking about, and I think it's called the ECHO Project, Dr. Houston, but the ability for nationwide and other practitioners in an urban area that have more clinicians to be able to do some training with local pediatricians who may have a sizable amount of kids in their practice that have psychiatric disorders or are on medication. It's been enormously helpful for them to learn a little bit more about what they're dealing with and to be able to serve those kids and families in a much better way. So that kind of technology stretching out from urban areas to rural areas is really critical, because as you know, we have like 30% of the psychiatrists we need in this country, and probably 25% of the child psychiatrists we need. So we can't grow them quickly enough to provide all the help that we need out there. So those things are really important.
We are talking about child psychiatric health and mental health and mental disorders. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. That was Jody Demohagens. She's director for the Children's Division at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Ohio. Also with us, Parker Houston, clinical director of the On Our Sleeves program at Nationwide Children's Hospital, which works to break silence around children's mental health. And also Dr. Patricia Gentile. She is a child and adolescent psychiatrist at the Buckeye Ranch. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Nearly one in five adolescents has a diagnosable mental health disorder. Nearly one-third of them show signs of depression, and that was before the pandemic. Behavioral health services were available, struggle to manage the load, especially in rural areas. We're talking about that today. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Still with us, pediatric psychologist Parker Houston. He's clinical director of the On Our Sleeves program at Nationwide Children's Hospital. By Zoom, Jody Demohagens, director of the Children's Division at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Ohio. And from Athens, Ohio, Janet, whose son was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder in his 20s. After difficult teenage years, she now helps other parents through the process with NAMI Athens. And she asked that her name, last name, not be used to preserve her son's privacy. Janet, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You live in rural southern Ohio. What challenges did that present when your son was a young man 2 decades ago?
Well, actually, we lived in New Jersey when all of this, when this reared its ugly head.
Okay.
And so it still presented a lot of challenges. But we had quite a bit of access to medical care. The thing was that we didn't know, what was going on. I thought I was being a bad mother. I thought my son was being a difficult teenager. I taught high school kids forever. And of course, I wouldn't think, gee, maybe he's got a brain disorder. I would mm-hmm. never go there as a, what was happening. But we did get him a psychiatrist. He got on medication, but he had kind of withheld some of the symptoms he had. So he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. However, it came to the fore while we were in Athens that he was also hearing voices, but he hadn't told anybody that. So he has a combination of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, which is called schizoaffective disorder. But we were really at sea at the very beginning. We didn't know what to do. And if I just may go off for a second, the thing that saved our lives was NAMI's family-to-family course. We took that in New Jersey, and then when we moved to Athens, I became a teacher, and then I became a member of the board of directors of NAMI Ohio, and I have taught Family to Family Plus. I've taught people to teach Family to Family. So I just want to give a shout out sure. to that if there are people who are listening who have no idea what has hit them, which
right.
is exactly what happened to my husband and me.
I think that that's so important, and appreciate you bringing up that issue. You know, Jody DeMohajans, to what extent does the Family to Family support system play a role in all of this? Now, you know, 40 odd years later when it comes to Janet, but it certainly evolved since then, hasn't it?
Oh, it's evolved in so many wonderful ways. Now there's a program called NAMI Basics. And NAMI Basics is really a program for entry-level people who have a child typically under the age of 13 or 14 who is exhibiting some mental health conditions. So NAMI Basics builds on the lessons learned from family to family, and it takes it to a different level for parents with kids who are much younger, the goal being to get them into care and to get them help earlier so it doesn't, so their lives aren't as disrupted as they could be if their diagnosis happens at a later date. I too have been a family-to-family trainer. It's just a great program because it's fact and science-based, and it provides a lot of different tools and information for families out there who are really desperate for that kind of assistance.
Parker Houston, how does family support groups play a role going forward in all of this?
Well, I think community support and family support in general is one of the biggest areas of development for children's mental health, in my opinion. You know, given all these discussions we're having about lack of care and lack of access and the difficulty in providing access to everyone who needs it, one of the things that I think we could focus on as a society and as mental health workers and people interested in mental health is, you know, preparing families and communities, pediatricians and teachers and educators to provide, you know, basic levels of support, understanding, empathy, help with identifying concerns. And, you know, sometimes, you know, that NAMI program, the NAMI Basics, I've heard of some people who have taken that and had really great things to say. You know, we talked about Project Echo and mm-hmm. All the different trainings that are being provided there. And I think it pays attention to the fact that, you know, we need more eyes on these type of issues for kids, and we need it earlier to prevent, you know, as we were just saying, prevent issues from coming up later in life, or at least prepare families and children to receive services when they're needed. And so, you know, we have quite a few parent training and caregiver and teacher training modules here at the hospital that we've developed. And what we see is that it really increases their knowledge and ability to use language about mental health and to be educated about, you know, when's it time to bring either my child or to recommend a child I'm working with to see a mental health provider. what type of questions to ask when you do get referred or when you do meet someone for the first time. And, you know, navigating the mental health system can be a daunting task for parents, as I'm sure Janet can attest. You know, just knowing what to say, what to ask, what to, you know, when to get a second opinion or when to question a decision or, you know, what does that term mean? And so I think the more education and the more conversation we can have about these topics, the more likely society in general is to be accepting of conversations and, you know, just bring the whole entire level of understanding and knowledge up a few notches.
We have an email from Jen. She writes that, I have a 17-year-old with severe depression and anxiety. His counselor is only doing telehealth visits, and he's 100% uncomfortable with that. His counselor is okay with that and will pick back up with him once they go back to in-person sessions. In the meantime, he has asked for a new counselor, and I believe that he needs one. I have made two appointments, but when the day comes for the appointment, he cannot make himself go and gets physically sick at the thought of going. I would love any advice to help my son get to the counselor. I'm not sure who to ask about this, but Jody Demo-Hodgins, maybe?
I'm wondering whether or not a conversation around whether he'd be willing to re-engage with the initial counselor would be helpful. A lot of times we expect that talking to somebody is going to make a difference quicker. And a lot of times it takes a longer period of time to just engage and develop that relationship. So I guess one suggestion for the mom would be to see whether he'd be willing to go back to the initial counselor. The second piece of that is if he does express a willingness to do that, would he be more comfortable not doing it completely face to face? So if you're doing it via Zoom, you can turn off the video function.
Okay.
That part of what is making him uncomfortable. I mentioned that because I talked to a mother last week who was really struggling with her son, or week before last, who was struggling with her son participating in the telehealth, and they we suggested they try that, and she called me the end of last week and said basically he had re-engaged and was willing to do it that way and had had two sessions. So with kids, you have to kind of ask them what things they might be comfortable with. It's hard to start cold with somebody brand new doing it via telehealth. So that would be one short suggestion. And then figure out what other kinds of support things that he might be able to participate in. Our Youth Move program is doing a series they call Summer Zooms. And it's obviously you can turn off the video portion, but it's like chat and fun stuff with other kids who have lived experience with a mental health condition. And it's their way to provide support to one another.
Janet, any ideas?
Was this his session with a psychiatrist? Is that what you said?
Well, it's with a counselor.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say counselor. My son always had a talk therapist and a psychiatrist, but he didn't have, of course it wasn't during the COVID stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I would absolutely agree with Jody, and I think I would so welcome the parents to come to the family to family. And I know I'm just beating the drum on that, but
in other words, even if he won't participate at this point, they should get out and get involved with the parent-to-parent group.
I think so, because this is not a casserole disease. When my friends found out about this, they stopped sharing their kids' successes because they didn't want to make me feel bad. And that made me feel alienated. When I went to family, this absolutely confidential group of people, I was with 13 other people who had just felt they'd been run over by a bus. And we all got to talk and we all got to figure things out. And we talked about our sadness, our loss. We talked about our kids' loss. We talked about how we were going to get through this and how we were going to approach the medical side. We learned all about what was happening in the brain of our kid. and why they were acting the way they were. And it was just, it was a miracle. So I hate to keep beating the drum, but it saved my life. Yeah. It saved my husband's life.
Yeah. So, Parker Houston?
Yeah. I mean, that's a powerful story, Janet. And Jody, I agree with your suggestions about this particular young man. You know, I think if I were the therapist and if a patient of mine had said, you know, I'm just not really digging the video chat thing, let's wait until we can be in person. That's a little bit different from I'm not digging it, but I also can't leave my house and I can't function right now and I need assistance now. So I think if the parents tried to reengage with the therapist and let them know, you know, we're trying to get him some assistance, but he just can't even leave the house right now. And it seems like he's really not functioning. I think there's a little bit different tone for the therapist of, well, let's do like a 5-minute session. And, you know, then I can talk with your parents, or let's turn the video off, as Jody was saying, or let's talk about something different this time and just get used to communicating on video. You know, lots of different ways to get him engaged with telehealth, not knowing, you know, if we knew that in a month or two we'd be back seeing people in person all the time, that might be different. But, you know, we're not getting word yet on the provider side that we should be doing much more in-person stuff, except in cases of an emergency for the foreseeable future. So I wouldn't want him to go without services, especially leading up to the school year, and, you know, have him, you know, really struggling and missing out on a lot this year without receiving some help.
I have an email from Jose who writes, my 5-year-old, one of identical twins, stopped talking the last 40 days, showing signs of anxiety, bit more aggressive behavior. Please help us give an idea for us to move forward. Parker Houston, I'll start with you.
Yeah, selective mutism, certainly a sign of anxiety in a lot of kids. And right around that age is the typical development of those symptoms. So I don't know where Jose and his family are living, but if they're in the state of Ohio or really anywhere near here, we actually have a few specialists at Nationwide Children's who deal with selective mutism and similar issues in young kids. And so I'd invite them to reach out and call the hospital line at 614-722-2000 and ask for the behavioral health intake. And you could talk with them about getting connected with someone to provide some information, education, and treatment.
Could you give us that number again, Parker?
Yeah, it's 614-722-2000.
Okay.
That's the main hospital line, and you can just ask for the behavioral health intake.
It is a sign, though, that you should be getting help for them.
Yeah, 40 days is a pretty long time to go without speaking. You know, every kid goes through some periods of time where they might be a little more quiet or reserved, but especially given the age of the child, and, you know, if they're 5, my guess is that they're probably about to start school or start back to school here in a couple months. And that's usually not the time when kids blossom, if they're feeling like that. And if they're already a bit reserved and not talking at home, it typically is a time where those symptoms might get even a little bit more ingrained or a little bit worse, unfortunately. So trying to get ahead of it and, you know, connect with someone as soon as possible would be my suggestion.
Well, Parker Houston, clinical director of the On Our Sleeves program at Nationwide Children's Hospital, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thanks, Dan.
And Jody Demo-Hodgins, director for the Children's Division at the National Alliance on Mental Illness Ohio. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much, Ann.
And Janet, thanks for your work. Thanks for your help and the insights with your own story, with your son, with mental illness, and your work with the National Alliance on Mental Illness Athens. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann. I appreciate the time.
Thanks to everybody else listening. Appreciate your time. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.